So your book, Farm City, chronicles your path to becoming an urban farmer in downtown Oakland, California. Tell us about how you became an urban farmer.
Well, my parents were back to the land hippies in Idaho. And so I had kind of grown up in this environment of growing your own food and eating healthy food and kind of a DIY spirit. I lived in Seattle for a long time. I went to school there at University of Washington. And when I was there, I started working for a book publishing company. We published a book called The Encyclopedia of Country Living. And I remember sitting in my office cubicle and sort of laughing about, you know, the various country living kind of things that this book would teach you, like how to kill a pig and, you know, how to shear a sheep and, you know, make cheese and things like that. And I remember sitting in my cubicle and thinking, well, you know, some of this stuff you don't actually need a lot of land to do. The book is written by a woman named Carla Emery, and, you know, she makes pickles and jams, and she was kind of like the 70s version of Martha Stewart, if you can imagine that. And she's actually from Idaho, and my parents actually knew her, which is a sort of a weird coincidence. So some of the stuff, you know, like raising chickens or making jam, you know, you don't need 40 acres to do that. And so I started to experiment from things from that book. I started to keep bees as well. So it was just sort of like I started doing little hobby stuff, and I had a little urban hobby farm in Seattle. But I never called it that because I hadn't, you know, I had never heard that term. And it really took me moving to Oakland. When I moved to Oakland, because I just couldn't handle the rainy weather in Seattle anymore and decided to move to California. And once I moved to Oakland, I found all these other people around me that were doing similar things. They were growing all their own food in these vacant lots. They're raising chickens and ducks and all kinds of stuff. And they're like, oh, yeah, we call ourselves urban farmers. And I was like, oh, wow, okay, cool. So that's kind of how I became an urban farmer, is, you know, just having that kind of background from my parents, but then also just willing to go ahead and do that, all that stuff in the city.
So in your book, you talk about the farm you established in Oakland, but yeah. You didn't just take over a farm. You sort of created one. Give us a sense of what the space looked like when you first came to it.
My partner and I, Billy, we moved into an apartment near downtown Oakland. And part of the cool thing about the apartment was there's this giant abandoned lot right next door. And there had been an apartment building there, and it had burned down in the 70s. And now it was a vacant lot that people were just like mostly throwing trash, and there was lots of weeds that had grown up. The place was just a mess. But to me, when I looked at it, I was like, wow, this is the most land I would have had access to in a long time. You know, it's about an eighth of an acre. So it's just a city lot, basically. And so that was why we started sort of farming on this land. Of course, we don't own the land and we have no right to use the land, but we kind of just decided to be squatters. And the gate was open, so we would just open up the gate and go in and pull up the weeds and put in some planter beds. And when I come to Kalamazoo, I actually have slides that'll show the sort of transformation of the garden from this abandoned lot to an actual garden slash farm.
And one of the reasons why you use the term farm is that you actually had animals on the space as well.
Yeah. When we had moved from Seattle, we didn't bring our chickens, but quickly we ended up getting chickens, and we brought our bee boxes from Seattle and got bees. And then I started dabbling in other projects. You know, one of the things that about the Bay Area that was so interesting is that other people were kind of there doing things. So, you know, I would meet people and they would be like, yeah, we're going to go kill a chicken today. And they'd be really excited about it. And I just remember being like, wow, maybe I should try to raise a turkey, like a Thanksgiving turkey. I've always been kind of into that idea of like the perfect American bird. And it, you know, really means a lot to Americans. And so that's how I started raising turkeys on the lot. But we also have a backyard too. So a lot of the animals were more in the backyard, not because, you know, in a lot with an open gate, a lot of times that can be dangerous for the animals because they can get out or people might come by and steal them or something like that. So then we raised rabbits up on the deck of our apartment building. And then we started raising pigs as well. I don't know if that's like our high point or our low point, but we started raising pigs. And the reason we did that is because the dumpsters are filled with food in our neighborhood, in our, not in our neighborhood, but in our general area. And it was something we just started to think like, wow, you know, there's these dumpsters full of food. I don't want to eat that food, but, you know, like a pig might want to eat that food. So that's how we started raising pigs.
So when you talk about the dumpsters you all went into to get the food for the pigs, it was pretty shocking how much food was there. What did that sort of tell you about our food system in this country?
The dumpsters are kind of actually, it's weird. It's the monitor of the health of the economy. When the economy is booming, the dumpsters are filled with food. So at that time, it was around 2005 that we were raising the pigs. The economy was really good. You know, everyone was doing great. And so we would go back into the, and we started going to this organic grocery store, and we would find literally an entire dumpster of peaches. Or we would find wheels of brie, like giant whole wheels of brie. And so it was really this intense thing. So, you know, I mean, what it says about our food system is that when there's a booming economy, there's more waste. Because now when the recession happened in 2008, you know, we still would go out dumpster diving, you know, old habits die hard. And there would, the dumpsters wouldn't be full of food at all. So it was a really interesting kind of experiment. And now, of course, the boom is on and the dumpsters are full of food again. So it's kind of a weird cycle that you can see. There's a great documentary called Dive. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's all about dumpster diving people in LA. And it's just amazing the waste that we have. And a lot of it just doesn't go anywhere. It just goes straight to, you know, in California, it goes to a composting facility, but it's still wasted food that was totally fine and edible for people. It's a distribution problem, I think, more than anything, that these stores, you know, don't know what to do with the excess. And so they just throw it away. It's really sad.
So when you were dumpster diving, you were trying to feed your animals. And it sounds like from what you described as quite a bit of work, you also maintained other jobs while you were having and starting your urban farm. What goes into actually raising animals in an urban setting?
Well, there's a lot of maintenance. I mean, the first thing about raising farm animals is you have to have secure places for them to live. Believe it or not, there are predators in urban areas, raccoons and skunks and opossums and wild dogs. There's just so many things that can come in and eat your animals. So the real key thing I had to learn, and that's why the book is sort of the education of an urban farmer, because I made a lot of mistakes along the way. There's a lot of trial and error kind of things where, you know, I built this really jankety duck pen and my ducks got killed by an opossum. So I had to learn that you have to really make a really strong, secure coop for your animals to live in. That's just hard to do. To build those things takes a lot of energy. So that's hard. But then there's a lot of maintenance for the animals. The pigs were pretty smelly. So I had to constantly go get sawdust and try to put down sawdust to absorb the odors. And then the dumpster diving for the pigs. I mean, by the end, the pigs were eating like 9 buckets full of compost a day. and they were just so hungry. They're insatiable. And so it was a part-time job of its own. At the time, I had 3 part-time jobs. I worked for a bookstore and a nursery, and I was a freelance journalist. And this was like my 4th part-time job, was like feeding those pigs because they were so hungry. So those kinds of things are a lot of work, really, just feeding the animals, getting them watered. I mean, it's not a full-time job, but it's a part-time job.
You were starting this urban farm in Oakland, California, which has wonderful weather all year long, basically. Is urban farming something that people can do everywhere, or does it really require only certain places in the U.S.?
So 2 things about that. One is that whatever urban farm I've gone to, and it's amazing now that Farm City's been out for years now, but I've gone to different urban farms as I've traveled around, and each one of them sort of reflects the climate and, you know, the growing conditions of that place. For instance, I went to Salt Lake City, which has really cold weather in the winter and spring. I met this man, David Bell, Bell Organics, and he had this huge urban farm right in the middle of Salt Lake City. But he also had greenhouses. So he was growing stuff in greenhouses. And they were actually really beautiful greenhouses. He had gotten a grant from the USDA. And so And then I've also spent time in Detroit, which is kind of like the ground zero for urban farming, partially because, you know, it's one of the most blighted parts of America, right? There's all these abandoned lots and buildings and houses. And so they have a really hard weather system, too, as you know, but they have ways to get around it. Those people mostly are growing even in, you know, in really cold climates. You can actually do a four season harvest just by using row cover and greenhouses and hoop houses and that kind of stuff. And a lot of them are very impromptu, you know, like they're just using used recycled materials to create a greenhouse. That's what I saw in Detroit, at least. So I think that each place can have its own, you can work with the weather. It's just like farmers everywhere. But, you know, the thing is that you also have to have the condition of, you know, you don't really see a lot of urban farms happening in like Bel Air, California, or Boca Raton, Florida. It needs to be in a place where there's actually some economic instability that has created enough land to be available or that it's unused. So that's another criteria, really. It's not so much the weather, it's access to land that's our biggest kind of concern. Because, you know, like in San Francisco right now, there's a huge development boom going on. Silicon Valley has gone crazy, and urban farms are shutting down left and right. So you just see this kind of collapse of urban farming as there's a better market, because now developers are moving in and building condos instead of letting people have urban farms on, you know, abandoned land.
And beyond just the climate, what about the actual person who does the urban farming? What kind of disposition and sort of skills do you think are required to starting an urban farm?
Well, I don't know. Like when I started, it was kind of the disposition was you had to, well, for you always have to be willing to work really hard, just like any kind of farmer. You have to be willing to work hard and then also work with difficult situations, you know, so like if something happens, you have to deal with it and be able, you have to be resilient, basically. You have to be, you know, sort of hardworking and resilient. Those are things that all farmers are. The thing, too, about urban farming that's different, though, from being a rural farmer is you actually have to have people skills. You need to kind of be out there because you're going to be talking to people constantly. Anytime I go out in my garden and I'm working out there or on the farm, someone always walks by and wants to talk to me. So if you're the kind of person that's like, don't talk to me, I'm trying to work, you know, that's not going to work out. So you have to be kind of a sociable person for sure if you're going to actually have fun being an urban farmer. But you also have to be a salesperson. You have to kind of figure out a way to make it pay. So some people are, you know, doing the thing where they've become nonprofits. So there's, you know, like a nonprofit organizations that have just sprung up all over the place for urban farming. But then there's some people that are trying to make money from it too. And so, you know, they're selling to restaurants. And so you really have to be kind of a entrepreneur too, if you're really going to have your urban farm survive.
So give us a sense of what kind of production you have from your farm, urban farm. Was it enough to survive on?
Well, it's weird. I mean, like, I guess when you say surviving, it's hard to say. I definitely don't make enough money on the farm to make a living. It's definitely not like I wouldn't be like, hey, everyone, let's become urban farmers and like, you know, make a living that way. It's just a part-time job. It's just such a little small amount of money. But one thing I do is I sell to restaurants. I sell to a couple restaurants in the area. But we're talking really small orders. You know, I'm maybe selling some radishes and some cilantro and some kale. And, you know, I make like $40 or something. So it's not a huge revenue stream at all. But the thing I do is I do classes on the farm, and those actually, they actually make it worthwhile to make a little bit of money every month. And so it's really just an incremental, you know, it's definitely not going to pay the bills. You'd have to have, and this is the thing is like all small farmers struggle, because they can't ever grow enough food. So if you look at it in a city, it's the same thing. It's like, how will you make it pay? So a lot of people do tours and, they have educational programs that they have, besides just selling the produce, or they grow, starts. That's been a big thing lately, is to just, grow a bunch of tomato starts and sell those. Because there's just simply not enough land really to make it pay the bills in a way that we'd like them to.
At one point in the book, you describe taking a month, basically, and trying to live solely off the food produced on your farm.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Yeah. So, well, the reason I did that is, I think there's an American ideal of self-sufficiency. And I think anyone that's had a garden, will kind of look at it and say, wow, can I actually live off that? Like, what if I could just like be totally self-sufficient? That's a huge ideal for Americans, I think. And so that was what I wanted to try to do, just to see if it could happen. Plus, so many people would ask me, hey, are you able to live off everything that you grow yourself? There's also a woman named Joan Gesso, and she wrote a book called This Organic Life. And she lives off, she grows all of her own food on 1,000-square-foot piece of land, in New York. So I was like, yeah, maybe I can do what she did. So I did that. And I was able to survive. Like, I was able to grow all of my own food, and, I had honey from the bees and, eggs from the chickens. But, the thing that I realized is that ideal is it's very alluring until you actually start doing it. And I found myself sort of becoming less, I didn't want to share stuff like I used to. It used to be, people would come by the farm and I'd be like, hey, yeah, pick some greens, go for it or whatever. But when I was surviving on all my own food, I became very stingy and miserly about it. And I realized, this isn't why I live in a city. I don't grow food in a city. Growing food in a city, it doesn't make sense to kind of create this barrier, this like wall of, yourself, and you're just living off the land. Because why do you live in the city if that's so? It really made me kind of question what, this ideal of self-sufficiency. One of the things I love about living in a city is that I can go eat Chinese food. I can go buy some dumplings anytime I want. And that's kind of the greatest thing about living in a city, is this like access to all these different cultures and ways of eating. And so when I just sort of only stayed on my plot, I felt sort of like I had created an island, within the city. And that's definitely, I knew that is not what I want to do. That's what happened. But I also discovered that, there was lots of resources for me too. There was, a woman down the street she doesn't live there anymore. She moved away, but, sadly part of our gentrifying, process of Oakland. But, and she would have, she went by Grandma, and she would have these, dinners. And so I traded a huge bunch of collard greens for one of the dinners. And it was like the best dinner I've ever had because I was so hungry and also so carb starved. I didn't grow enough carbohydrates. So I was dying, just to get some kind of like carb into my body. So those kind of things were really, they showed me something about what I was doing, what my experiment really meant, and what is important to me about living in a city, and why do I grow food? And to me, it's like, I like to grow food to share it and have conversations with people about it, but I don't want it to be my only way of living. It's just too hard, and it's alienating ultimately to, my neighbors and my friends.
Yeah, talk about that, because in the book you describe how it was very difficult for you to go to places and hang out with friends when they were all partaking in food that you weren't able to because you were trying to live off your farm.
Yeah, it became kind of awkward. I'd go to a barbecue and I would just be like smelling that food and people were eating it, And of course I did the stunt in July, so it was like, prime barbecue season. And then I'd have my little, jar of plums or whatever I was eating, and it was kind of pathetic. Food is really not just about sustenance and feeding yourself. It's about creating community. So when I had created this thing where I'm like, I will only eat this food from my garden, I kind of ostracized myself from everyone too. So yeah, I realized like food is really, it's not just about, getting the calories in there.
You also mentioned in the book that you used to be a vegetarian and now you're actually raising and slaughtering your own animals. Talk about how your perception of food and your relation to food has changed over time.
Yeah, so I was a vegetarian for years in high school and then in college. And part of the reason was I just didn't want, it was a moral thing. I didn't want animals to die so I could eat. But then, like many vegetarians, I was sort of anemic and my health wasn't the greatest. And so when I started eating meat again, I just felt so much better. But I did, you know, I couldn't forget that idea of like, wow, you know, there's animals in slaughterhouses and, you know, these giant meat factories, basically. So I didn't really want to partake in that either. And I had read an essay by Michael Pollan, the New York Times Magazine. It was called Power Steer. And it was all of, he followed basically a cow from, you know, a calf to a steak and what happens in that. And it was just really horrifying for me to read that. But Pollan offered one hope, and that is you can actually buy organic grass-fed beef. So I started changing my diet and eating more healthier meat. The problem with that is that it's so expensive. So there's always this kind of, you're eating better meat, but then you can't eat as much of it. And then for me, because I'm such a DIY person, I thought, well, wow, why don't I try to grow my own? And then let's see if I can save money doing that. So what I realized, you know, with the pigs especially, is that definitely we grew two hogs to slaughter, and we had a lot of meat on our hands. So that saved money. But the amount of time that we spent raising the hogs was really high too. So you sort of start to realize there's some math to do. And that is that, you know, if you have more money, you have less time. And if you have less money, you have more time. So we started to realize that that was part of the cost analysis of raising the animals, is like, it's actually a hell of a lot of hard work. And takes a lot of time. So you have to be willing to do that. But I felt good about that. I wanted to put the hours in, and I wanted to actually, be with my animals and learn about their lives, and to give them a really happy life, before it was time for them to be slaughtered. It was an important time for sure for me, learning about where my meat comes from and what it means to eat meat even, you know. And I've had a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, I can never raise a chicken and kill it and eat it. But then I'll be like, well, do you eat meat? And they're like, yeah, you know. And I don't think everyone should go around killing all their own animals and eating them. You know, I think that's a little extreme. But for people to eat meat, I think it is important for them at least to go watch animal getting slaughtered and processed, because it is a big deal. And if you think it's disgusting, then maybe you shouldn't eat meat, you know. It's sort of a question about what you're doing. So I think it's just having that knowledge was really important to me, to actually know what it meant to eat meat.
One question that comes up when you're talking about raising your own animals in an urban setting is whether it's even legal. Are there particular rules or laws associated with urban farming?
There are, but it's usually by the town. So each town or city has its own ordinances. So, you know, even in the Bay Area, you know, we have a town in El Cerrito where chickens, you can't have chickens unless you have a special permit. But then Oakland has a rule that you can have, five chickens, no problem, without any kind of permit, but no roosters. And then Berkeley says you can have chickens, you can have roosters, you can do whatever, unless you're creating a nuisance, unless the neighbors are complaining. So every city will have a different ordinance. And some of the ordinances are really old, and they're sort of like back in the day, like when they were trying to decide what cities were, like how to, you know, sort of understand cities, there was a sort of an anti-immigrant bent to many of the laws. So they were like, no animals, you know, and that was sort of a way for people to just like, we don't want country people moving to the city and raising, you know, their animals in the city. Like, this is a city. But now we're sort of starting to see a shift where cities are like, okay, you can have chickens or you can have bees. So you see these laws starting to change now. And yeah, so it'll be basically city by city. But, you know, there have been, you know, huge battles where cities where they're trying to get the chicken ordinance changed, you know, and there's like the pro chicken people on one side and then there's the anti chicken people on the other. So it can be really rich for, you know, conversation setting about what a city is.
In your book, you mention that you think cities are the ideal place for farms. Most people think of farms in rural areas. Why do you think that cities are the best place for them?
Well, I think cities are great. Well, one is just the people are there. So, you know, you harvest food, it's there. You don't have to drive 5 hours from the country to go to a farmer's market and then sell your produce there. So you can just sell the freshest produce possible. There's also no or less oil used or, you know, gas or there's just less fuel used when you grow in the city. There's also the thing that I think it's good for people to see what the farms look like. I think people have this fantasy sometimes of, you know, oh, this, you know, farms are so beautiful. And that's, you know, there's like always the picture of the cow on the milk that's like out in this grassy field in a barn. But the reality is most farms are not like that. They're actually in these milk parlors all day and they never actually go out on grass. So farms when they're in the city, people see them, you know, you get to see what they look like. You get to see how the animals are treated. It's a very transparent kind of process. The other thing is I think people don't know, especially kids, although now there's a lot of school gardens, but they don't know where their food comes from. And it's kind of a basic human thing to just want to see where your food comes from and what a carrot looks like when it's growing before it's yanked out of the ground. And so there's kind of that, you know, I think with all the technology that people use, sometimes it's just nice just to get out into the dirt and kind of grub around and, you know, get sweaty shoveling stuff and pulling carrots and harvesting potatoes, because there's something real in that, which I think in cities, a lot of times it's just not real. There's no reality to it. But, you know, there's limitations to cities, too. I mean, cities, definitely, it's hard to find arable land, like I was talking about. So that's the big challenge for cities. I actually noticed there was an article about suburban farms in the New York Times a couple days ago. And in some ways, that makes a lot of sense, too. So suburbs tend to be fairly close to cities, but they have more land for, you know, doing bigger projects like raising milk cows or we had goats for a while. So you can raise goats in the city too, but if you really want to do it on a larger scale, you might have to go to the suburbs.
What advice would you give to people who are interested in becoming more self-sufficient or potentially even starting an urban farm?
Well, I usually tell people the best thing to do is to start really small. I think a lot of people have this idea like, wow, I'm just going to like make an Insta farm and I'm going to get chickens and goats and bees tomorrow and it's going to be great. And that's when you kind of run into problems because you need to learn each process as it goes. And it's a steep learning curve. You know, there's a lot of mistakes that can happen. So I usually recommend people start really slow and with small projects. And then if they like that, then they build. So just constantly building on past successes or failures and learning from those instead of just trying to like start just like some huge project all at once. The other thing I say is to find a mentor or find a place where you can learn from someone who already knows a lot of stuff. So, you know, you can look at a website and watch tons of YouTube videos, but the way you're really going to learn is actually doing it and watching someone, especially with raising animals or processing, killing chickens or rabbits or something like that. You really need to find a mentor. And that's what, you know, people like the master gardeners, that's what they're all about. They teach people how to grow, you know, they might be growing hydrangeas, but they also grow tomatoes. And so it's really nice just to have someone to show you what's worked for them. And then you can learn that and then learn more from your experiments.